Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. From Boston, Massachusetts, the President of the United States delivers another major address in his campaign for re-election to the presidency. We're speaking to you from the brilliantly lighted, colorful, and noisy Boston Garden, packed tonight with more than 23,000 Bostonians who've come to see, to hear, and to cheer the Democratic candidate. The chief executive's New England tour began this morning in New Haven. He inspected some national defense projects, and in spite of rain and murky weather, was greeted by large crowds in many towns and cities, principal among them Hartford, Springfield, and Worcester. He's dined with his younger son, John, and his wife, and arrived here just 2 minutes ago, where he's been greeted by this tremendous throng they've really let go. Some 250 prominent Democrats on the platform have served as a special welcoming committee for the chief executive. Among them, Senator Walz, Mr. Paul Dever, the Democratic candidate for governor, and Congressman McCormick, and Casey, and Connery, and Flaherty, and Healy, all up for re-election this year. Mayor Morris J. Tobin, the mayor of Boston, will introduce the chief executive. And we are going to introduce to you now the mayor of Boston, and perhaps he can quiet the crowd and we'll be ready to go. Here he is, His Honor, Mayor Tobin of Boston.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States. Mr. Mayor, my friends of New England, I've had a glorious day here in New England. And I don't need to tell you that I've been glad to come back to my old stamping ground in Boston. There's only one thing about this trip that I regret. I have to return to Washington tonight without getting a chance to go into my two favorite states of Maine and Vermont. This is the third inning. In New York City, two nights ago, I showed by the cold print of the congressional record how Republican leaders, with their votes and in their speeches, have been playing and still are playing politics with national defense. Even during the past 3 years, when the dangers to all forms of democracy throughout the world have been obvious, the Republican team in the Congress has been acting only as a party team. Time after time, Republican leadership refused to see that what this country needs is an all-American team. Those sideline critics are now saying that we're not doing enough for our national defense. I say to you that we are going full speed ahead. Now let's take them up in turn. Our Navy is our outer line of defense. Almost the very minute that this administration came into office 7.5 years ago, we began to build the Navy up, to build a bigger Navy. And in those 7 years, we have raised the total of 193 ships in commission to 337 ships in commission today. And in addition to that, we have 119 more ships that are actually under construction today. In those 7 years, we raised the personnel of our Navy from 106,000 to 210,000 today. You good people here in Boston know of the enormous increase of productive work in your Boston Navy Yard. And that's only one of many Navy yards, one of the best. There are now six times as many men employed in all of our Navy yards as there were back there in 33. And the private shipbuilding yards are also humming with activity, building ships for our Navy and also for that new expanding merchant marine of ours. Well, you know, and I know, and they know out on the farms of the Middle West that the construction of this Navy has been a monumental job. And in spite of what some campaign orators may tell you, you cannot buy a battleship from a mail order catalog. We've not only added ships and men to the Navy, we've enormously increased the effectiveness of naval bases in those outlying territories of ours in the Atlantic and the Pacific. For our objective is to keep any potential attacker as far from our continental shores as we possibly can. And you here in New England know well and visualize it that within the past 2 months, your government has acquired new naval and air bases in British territory in the Atlantic Ocean, extending all the way from Newfoundland on the north to that part of South America where the Atlantic Ocean begins to narrow, with Africa not far away. And so I repeat to you, our objective is to keep any potential attacker as far from our continental shores as we possibly can. That's the record. The record of the growth of our Navy. In 1933, a weak Navy. In 1940, a strong Navy. Sideline critics may carp in a political campaign, but Americans are mighty proud of that record, and Americans will put their country first and partisanship second. Go back to the old congressional record. Speaking of partisanship, I remind you when the Naval Expansion Bill came up in 1938, the vast majority of Republican members of the Congress voted against building any more battleships. What kind of political shenanigans are those? Can we trust those people with national defense. Next, take up the army under normal conditions. We have no need for a vast army in this country. But you and I know that unprecedented dangers require unprecedented action to guard the peace of America against unprecedented threats. Since that day, a little over a year ago, when Poland was invaded, we have more than doubled the size of our regular army. Adding to this, the federalized National Guardsmen, our armed land forces now equal more than 436,000 enlisted men. And yet there are armies overseas that run to 4 and 5 and 6 million men. The officers and men of this army of ours, the regular army and the National Guard, I say are the finest in the world. And they will be, as you know, the nucleus for the training of the young men who are being called under the Selective Service Act. 800,000 of them in the course of this year, out of nearly 17 million registered. In other words, a little less than 5% of the total registration. General Marshall said to me the other day that the task of training those young men is for the Army a profound privilege. Campaign orators seek to tear down the morale of the American people when they make false statements about the Army's equipment. I say to you that we are supplying our Army with the best fighting equipment in all the world. Yes, the Army and the Defense Commission are getting things done at speed and efficiency. More than $8 billion of contracts for defense have been let in the past few months. And I'm afraid that those campaign orators will pretty soon, if they keep on much further, they'll pretty soon be under the painful necessity of coming down to Washington later on and eating their words. But I can't help but feel that the most inexcusable, the most unpatriotic misstatement of fact about our Army, a misstatement calculated to worry the mothers of the nation, is the brazen charge that the men called to training will not be properly housed. The plain fact, the provable fact, is that construction on Army housing is far ahead of schedule to meet all needs, and that by January 5th next, there will be complete and adequate housing in this nation for 930,000 soldiers. And so I feel that very simply and very honestly, I can give assurance to the mothers and to the fathers of America that each and every one of their boys in training will be well housed and well fed. Throughout that year of training, there will be constant promotion of their health, of their well-being. And while I'm talking to you, fathers and mothers, I give you one more assurance. I have said this before, but I shall say it again and again and again. Your boys are not going to be sent into any foreign war. They are going into training to form a force so strong that by its very existence, it will keep the threat of war far away from our shores. Yes, the purpose of our defense is defense. The Republican campaign orators who moan and groan about our Army and Navy, they're even more mournful about our strength in the air. But only last year, 1939, the Republicans in the Congress of the United States were voting in favor of reducing appropriations for the Army Air Corps. And so I have to say again, what kind of political shenanigans are these? Can such people be trusted with national defense? I say no. I am stressing, of course, rightly, what every Army and Navy flyer tells us, that what counts most in sustained air power is the productive capacity of our airplane and engine factories. That ought to be almost a first grade lesson. We are determined to attain a production capacity of 50,000 planes a year in the United States. And day by day, we are working and making very rapid progress toward that goal. For example, the citizens of Seattle, Washington, you citizens of Seattle, Washington, who are listening tonight, you have watched the Boeing plant out there grow. It's now producing four times as many planes each month as it was producing a year ago. And you citizens of Southern California, you can see the great Douglas factories. They have doubled their output in less than a year. And you citizens of Buffalo and St. Louis can see the Curtis plants in your cities. Their output has jumped 12 times its level of a year ago. And of course, we're training the young men and training them successfully in sufficient numbers to fly these planes as soon as they come off the line. But planes won't fly without engines. You citizens of Hartford, where I was this morning, you hear my words, look across the Connecticut River at the whirring wheels and the beehive of activity that is the Pratt and Whitney plant that I saw. A year ago, that plant was producing airplane engines totaling 100,000 horsepower a month. Today, that production has been stepped up tenfold, stepped up to 1 million horsepower a month. And you citizens of Paterson, New Jersey, you can see the Curtis Wright plant, which a year ago produced 270,000 horsepower a month, and this October, this month, is producing 859,000 horsepower. And so, just one more figure. In the past 10 months, this nation has increased our engine output for planes 240%, and I'm proud of it. Remember, too, that we are scattering them all over the country. We're building brand new plants for airplanes, for airplane engines, in places beside the Pacific coast and this coast. We're also building them in centers in the Middle West, rightly. Last spring, last winter even, a year ago, this great production capacity program was stepped up by orders from overseas. And in taking these orders for planes from overseas, we were following and we are following hard-headed self-interest. Building on the foundation provided by these orders, the British on the other side of the ocean are receiving a steady stream of airplanes. And after 3 months of blitzkrieg in the air over there, the strength of the Royal Air Force is actually greater now than when the attack began. And they know, and we know, that that increase in strength, despite battle losses, is due in part to the purchases made from American airplane industries and American workers. Tonight I am privileged to make an announcement using Boston instead of the White House. The British, within the past few days, have asked for permission to negotiate again with American manufacturers for 12,000 additional planes. And I have asked that that request be given most sympathetic consideration by the Priorities Board. I have asked the Priorities Board to give it that consideration. The board made up of William S. Knudsen, Edward R. Stettinius Jr., and Leon Henderson. When those additional orders are approved, as I hope they will be, they will bring Britain's present orders for military planes from the United States to more than 26,000. And we must remember that those orders will require still more new plant facilities, so that the present program of building planes for military purposes, both for the United States and Britain, will not be interrupted. With that request, come orders, large additional orders, negotiated for artillery, for machine guns, for rifles, for tanks with equipment and ammunition. And again, the plant capacity necessary to produce all of this military equipment is and will be available to serve the needs of the United States in any emergency. The productive capacity of the United States that I've talked about which has made it the greatest industrial country in the world, is not failing now. It's going to make us, it is making us, the strongest air power in all the world. And that is not just a campaign promise. I have been glad in the past two or three days to welcome back to the shores of America, that Boston boy, beloved by all of Boston and a lot of other places, my ambassador to the court of St. James, Joe Kennedy. Actually on the scene where planes were fighting and bombs were dropping day and night. For many months, he has been telling me just what you and I have visualized from afar, that all of the smaller independent nations of Europe, Sweden and Switzerland and Greece and Ireland and the others, all of them have lived in terror of the destruction of their independence by Nazi military might. And so, my friends, we are building up our armed defenses to their highest peak of efficiency for a very good reason. The reason of the possibility of real national danger to us. But these defenses will be inadequate unless we support them with a strong national morale, a sound economy, a sense of solidarity, and economic and social justice. When this administration first came to office, the foundation of that national morale was crumbling. In the panic, in the misery of those days, no democracy could have built up an adequate armed defense. What we have done since 1933 has been written in terms of improvement in the daily life and the daily work of the common man. I have discussed the falsifications which Republican campaign orators have been making about the economic condition of the nation, the condition of labor, and the condition of business. They are even more ridiculous when they shed those old crocodile tears over the plight of the American farmer. Now, if there's anyone that a Republican candidate loves more than the laboring man in October and up to Election Day, it's the farmer. And the very first one that he forgets after Election Day is the farmer. Do I have to remind you of the plight of the farmer, not just the Western farmer, but the New England farmer, during the period between 1920 and 1933? Declining income, accumulating surpluses, rising farm debts, 10-cent corn and 20-cent wheat and 5-cent cotton and 3-cent hogs. I said it all in 1936, and it's just as true today in the history of this country as it was then. But before 1933, the administration did nothing to stop that slide. But of course, before every Election Day, they always uncorked the old bottle of soothing syrup and spread it thick. Why, the farmers of America know from the record what the state of American agriculture is today. For instance, farm income this year is just about double what it was in 32. And farm buying power this year is greater than it was even in 1929. Tens of thousands of farmers have had their farms saved from foreclosure. More than 800,000 low-income farmers have been able to obtain credit from the government, credit that they could get nowhere else, and incidentally, credit which they are repaying. Over 1 million farms have been electrified since 33, and over 6 million farmers, that's a lot of farmers. Over 6 million farmers have received benefit payments of more than $3.5 billion. Well, what does it all add up to? It means an agriculture that's strong and vigorous. And we all know how much that is due to the patient efforts and the practical vision of Henry Wallace. People of New England, whether they live in the city or out in the country, they know full well that if the farmers' income in this nation had remained what it was in 1932, they would be buying fewer shoes and fewer watches and ice boxes, less woolen goods, less cotton goods than they are buying now. Prosperous farmers mean more employment, more prosperity for the workers and the businessmen of New England and of every industrial area in the whole country. And so, we're still striving for the goal, parity, the proper relationship between agriculture and the rest of our economy, that will continue to be our guiding principle. Why, we now have great stocks of wheat and corn and cotton. In a sense, really strategic materials in a world that is threatened by war. But surpluses not needed for reserves are now being used to feed the hungry and the ill-nourished. And that's a fact that's difficult for the old Republican orators to deny. On just one little item of that, our school luncheon program. Why, that will reach 3 million children with milk and other foods this year. And milk does those children more good than political soothing syrup. And while this was being done, what were the Republican leaders doing? Here's the record. In 1933, Republicans in the Congress in both houses voted against the first Agricultural Adjustment Act. In the House of Representatives, 88-52. In 36, they voted against the Soil Conservation and Domestic Allotment Act, 75-25. In 1938, they voted against the second Agricultural Adjustment Act, 84-15. And even in 1940, this year, they voted against parity payments to farmers by 143-32. And in the spring of this year, they voted overwhelmingly against the stamp plan, to distribute food to needy people through private grocery stores. No, the American farmers will not be deceived by pictures of old God candidates patting cows and pitching hay in front of moving picture cameras. And even since the convention in Philadelphia, all the sweet words of the Republican leaders in that convention have not been worth the paper they were written on. Well, listen to this. Last summer, only a few weeks after the Republican National Platform had been adopted, endorsing commodity loans for farmers, the Republican members of the House marched right back into the halls of Congress and voted against commodity loans for the farmers to the tune of 106-37. Now, among the Republican leaders who voted against that bill and against practically every other farm bill for the United States was the present chairman of the Republican National Committee, that peerless leader, that farmer's friend, Congressman Joe Martin of Massachusetts. I wouldn't single him out, except that he's of national interest now, because at the time of his appointment as Republican National Chairman, there was pinned on him the following handsome verbal bouquet, this expensive orchid. He was called in public life for many years, Joe Martin has represented all that is finest in American public life. Considering the source of that orchid, Martin must be slated for some cabinet post. So let's look for a minute at the voting record of this gentleman, this representative of what they call all that is finest in American public life. Martin voted against the Public Utility Holding Company Act, the Tennessee Valley Authority Act, the National Securities Exchange Act, and the extension of the Civilian Conservation Corps Act. He voted against practically all relief and work relief measures and against the appropriation for rural electrification. Martin voted against the Civil Service Extension Act and against the United States Housing Act. So what I want particularly to say on the radio to the farmers of the nation, and to you here in this hall, is that Republican National Chairman Martin voted against every single one of the farm measures that were recommended by this administration. Perhaps said, wait a minute. Perhaps Brother Martin will be rewarded for this loyal service to the principles of his party by being appointed Secretary of Agriculture. And I still remember from two nights ago. He is one of that great historic trio which has voted consistently against every measure for the relief of agriculture, Martin, Barton, and Fish. I will have to let you in on a secret. It will come as a great surprise to you, and it's this. I'm enjoying this campaign, and I'm really having a fine time. But I think you know that the office of president has not been an easy one during the past years. The tragedies of this distracted world have weighed heavily on all of us. But there is revival for every one of us in the sight of our own national community. In our own American community, we have sought to submerge all of the old hatreds, all the old fears of the old world. We are Anglo-Saxon and Latin. We're Irish and Teuton and Jewish and Scandinavian and Slav. We are America. We belong to many races and colors and creeds. We are America. And it seems to me that we are most completely, most loudly, most proudly American around Election Day. Because it is then that we can assert ourselves, voters and candidates alike. We can assert the most glorious, the most encouraging fact in all the world today. The fact that democracy is alive and going strong. Yes, we are telling the world that we are free, and we intend to remain free and at peace. We are free to live and love and laugh. We face the future with confidence and with courage. We are Americans.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have heard the President of the United States deliver his third major political address within the past week. Tonight he spoke from Boston Garden, where he has been cheered by more than 23,000 party supporters. He was introduced by Mayor Morris J. Tobin of Boston. The cheering continues and will for some little bit, but the ceremonies are ended. The special broadcast has come to you from the Boston Garden in Boston, Massachusetts. This is Carlton Smith speaking.
The program you have just heard was under the sponsorship of the Democratic National Committee. Kay Kaiser's College of Musical Knowledge, sponsored by Lucky Strike, and usually broadcast during the past hour, was not heard tonight because of the special program just concluded. This is the National Broadcasting Company.